Hi guys, Alana Terry here. You are listening to the Successful Writer Podcast. I'm glad you joined us. Today I have a guest who is my own husband. So Scott has recently been certified as a Myers-Briggs, consultant?
Type Indicator Practitioner.
Got it. Practitioner. And so for those of you familiar with Myers-Briggs, Scott can now officially help people figure out their personality type. If you don't know Myers-Briggs, you're going to learn all about it. And so we want to talk specifically today about how to know your type and specifically how your unique personality type can and will influence things like your creativity, your productivity. So today's episode is all about Myers-Briggs for authors, basically. So welcome to Scott.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm glad we could spend some time tonight talking about something. This is something that's been pretty near and dear to my heart as a amateur for several years. And moving from the amateur realm into the professional realm has really just deepened my understanding of what the Myers-Briggs type indicator is and given me a much broader understanding of how that can be used.
Right, right. So if you don't know, Scott works in the foster care industry, and so he licenses foster families. So his training in Myers-Briggs, I think we'll probably use Myers-Briggs and MBTI, but Myers-Briggs
type indicator
is MBTI. We'll use those interchangeably. But yeah, he just got officially certified so that he can take this information to the foster parents he works with, and things like that. So there are tons of applications aside from just being really interesting to learn about your type. So let's dive in. So for those of you who maybe aren't familiar at all, the Myers-Briggs, they give you four letters. And so I think, is it going to be easiest to just talk about kind of each letter pairing first?
Well, let's step back just a little bit. I'd like to give a little bit of kind of input as to what the MBTI is. So Myers-Briggs, the type indicator, is an assessment that was developed by a mother-daughter pair, Myers and Briggs, back in the 60s, maybe even a little bit before they were doing some of the work. And they based that work off of psychologist Carl Jung, J-U-N-G. And what they did is they took his work and kind of broadened it a little bit in order to make it more applicable for the everyday person. And then over the course of the last 40 years, 60 years actually, they have really kind of narrowed down that focus to where they have a fantastic tool that really gives a very deep understanding of one's individual personality type. And what that does, it starts out by giving us what we call our preference pairs or our preferences. And that's what we'll kind of get into. So there are four preference pairs. There are eight preferences. And Alana, do you want me to go ahead and kind of work through that?
Yeah. Well, you know, what's really funny is that you and I are the exact opposite on every single pair. And so maybe like you could explain your side of the pair. I'll explain my side of the pair. And then we can give some tips for authors based on where they are.
Sure. That works for me.
So first pair, why don't you start? The extrovert.
the first preference pair is whether or not you're natural tendency or natural preference is to be an extrovert or to be an introvert. And what this is it's an understanding about how we gain energy and how we direct energy. So as an extrovert, I gain energy from the outside world. So a lot of people kind of look at extroverts and think, oh, well, you know, they're people. They want to be out in big crowds all the time. They like to have parties. They like to go out. They hate to be alone. And that's not necessarily a true statement, especially as I get older. I find myself, as my beloved bride likes to tell me, I'm a homebodied introvert. Or I'm sorry, extrovert, a homebodied extrovert.
Yeah.
I still gain my energy from the outside world, whether that's a radio or a podcast or television or a book. Sometimes it's sitting down and talking with people. But I usually find myself wanting to stay at home. You know, I work all day. I'm out of the house for 10 hours a day. When I get home, I don't want to go anywhere. But I find that when I do go somewhere, especially if it's a small group setting or even a large group setting, I find myself really highly energized at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other funny thing is that when you're at home, like if I were in an office setting for 10 hours a day, working a super stressful job like you do, I would want to come home and like take an hour long bath and then sit in a massage chair for an hour and then like do yoga for half an hour. And then maybe I would feel ready to come downstairs and talk to people. But like when you come down, like, you know, you talk, you're chatty. There's usually TV going on, even if it's just for background noise.
Yeah. I really have found that I always have to have multiple streams of information. Mm-hmm. I used to think it was kind of an adult ADHD, and really it's not. It's just as an extrovert, I gain energy from the outside world. So
yeah,
if I have multiple streams, mm-hmm. it's energizing.
Yeah, it's harder for you to work in silence.
Absolutely. When I was in college, I could not turn the TV off, turn whatever off, and just mm-hmm. sit and write a paper in silence. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But I could have maybe an audiobook going and have a television show like Mythbusters in the background,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and I could write a 10-page paper in 2 or 3 hours,
yeah.
and do all the research and really feel like I've done a good job. But if it were quiet, if I were in the library, I can't do it. It just doesn't work for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think most authors, you know, so correct me if I'm wrong, I can't think of a single career that caters more toward introverts than being an author. Can you? I mean, I'm sure there are, like, I don't know, a monk.
Yeah, maybe. I can't think of, you know, I mean, it's you're so much in your own head.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
For what you do. I think you're probably right. This might be the specialty.
Mm-hmm. But there are extroverted authors. And I think what Scott was saying about, you know, needing noise, you know, I know some people prefer to work in a coffee shop or put on, you know, background music. So if that helps you focus, then that makes total sense. Any tips? So picture yourself as a full-time writer or, you know, doing something behind the computer all day, and yet you're an extrovert. What would be the couple things that you would do to make sure that you were still, I guess, working at your peak capacity and not ignoring the side of you that really likes, you know, that extra input and lots of activity and stuff?
Yeah, I would, as an extrovert, I wouldn't be able to just sit in an office and write a book in silence. I would have to have stuff going on. And
you would
like,
probably write a book with Star Trek playing in the background.
Absolutely. I would put Star Trek on. I'd put Stargate SG-1 on. You know, something. And it isn't even really music. It has to. Music mm-hmm. doesn't really energize me as much as some other people
That's
do.
Funny.
For me, the spoken word is really, it's kind of that gaining information. Even when I'm at the gym, and I go to the gym for a couple of hours a day, but I don't listen to music like most people do. I listen to an audiobook. It has to engage me, as to where with music, a lot of people, well, I'm assuming, it just they disengage with the music because it's there just kind of feeding them. I don't know. I don't really understand it personally.
Because you're not an introvert.
Because I'm not an introvert. So I have to have some sort of like information gain
right.
in order to do it. So if I were a writer, I would put Star Trek on, I'd go to a coffee shop, but not a quiet coffee shop.
Mm-hmm.
It'd have to be a place where there's, you know, people coming and going. You know, I might even just keep the door open and let the kids run in and out because that's...
You gotta have a little bit of chaos.
Yeah, because lack of chaos and I, as an extrovert, don't really do well.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes total sense. And I'm going to assume that most people listening know what it's like to be an introvert, but... You know, I'm pretty classic introvert. Like I just said, if I were away from the home for hours a day, I'd come home and just need a lot of quiet time to recharge. I've talked before on the podcast when I travel, how hard it is for me to not get sick just because all the noise and activity is really stressful. So I think, you know, Scott's right too, that writing really is a great job for an introvert. And in that case, I would say some tips for you is to just realize that, yeah, you're going to need that little bit of a break. So for example, we're recording this less than a week from when I got back from the 20 Books Conference in Vegas. And today was my first day where I wrote anything. And literally it was like 160 words. And I need to be okay with that because I was there and there was so much activity that I know I need to give my introversion time to just kind of refuel and recharge before I can expect to perform at peak capacity.
Absolutely. And that's what's so important about understanding if you're an introvert or an extrovert. And It's interesting. A lot of people, this is one of those preference pairs where people really get tripped up. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think, well, I'm shy, right. I'm quiet, therefore I'm an introvert.
Hmm.
That isn't, it isn't even like a majority necessarily.
So you can be a shy extrovert.
Absolutely. You know, I think of, or you can be an introvert that is very gregarious because you have to be. I think of pastors. I know an awful lot of pastors who their job is to be out with people and they're preaching,
yeah.
But they are some of the most introverted people I know. Mm-hmm. And then I've known some people who are extroverts that they have to, you know, work in an office where it's quiet all day, and we're able to kind of train ourselves to do those things. But what one thing that's really important is not just taking, I'm an introvert and running with it, but actually looking at what makes us an introvert, why we're an introvert or an extrovert. There's a lot more to it than just saying, well, I'm shy or I'm quiet, or saying, having somebody else tell you, you know, hey, Alana, I believe you're an introvert. Well, just because I've said that, I don't really know what's going on inside you.
Right.
And I would guess, at least within my training, whenever anybody tried to label somebody, they were probably wrong about 35% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know your type. You know your preference better than anybody else. Somebody can tell you you're something. That has nothing to do with the reality. The reality is who you are.
That makes a ton of sense. If you are introverted or you want to understand introversion better, there's a really good book called Quiet. And I heard about it once and like, how can there be a book about being an introvert? But it was actually really, really good. I really recommend that for just understanding, because I think society is kind of geared towards, like, society favors extroverts. You know, if you think about like who's popular in high school, it's the very bubbly, you know, bouncy, or who's going to get the raise. It's the squeaky wheel who's, you know, schmoozing the boss or things like that. And so sometimes, yeah, I think it's important to be okay with, you know, whichever you are. Yeah. All right. So the second preference, where are we up to? That's
N and S. The second preference pair is sensing or intuiting or intuition. And I am a sensor. This is an interesting one because for me, I didn't really get it until I was at the training. There was an activity that we did at the training that really helped me understand. But as a sensor, I use in order to gather information. That's what this preference pair is all about, how an individual gathers information. I use my five senses. Now, of course, we all use our five senses all the time. Now, of course, and there are more than just five senses, but we use sound, sight, touch, smell, hearing. We use all of these different senses in order to gather information. For me, that, as I try to understand the world around me, that's the most important thing. When I see a forest, I'm going to be looking at the individual trees instead of the huge forest that's in front of me. I want to see the individual items that make up the whole. And that's, as a sensor, what it means to me.
Yeah, I think one of the things, so I'm the opposite, as we already said, in all of these tendencies, Scott and I are the exact opposite. And so for me, as an N, for an intuitor, or
intuitors, you use intuition. So I use the word intuitor. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but it is what it is.
So I'm going to claim intuitor. So for me, I kind of take... like I'll look at something and think about how I feel. So a really, really good concrete example. When one of the kids is sick, I will send Scott a text and be like, oh yeah, poor guy, he's not feeling well. The very first thing Scott always asks is...
Without fail.
Yeah, without fail. Have you taken his temperature? Because he gets information with data and numbers and the concrete kinds of things. You know, the black and white things. If it's a fact, he can understand that. Whereas for me... I don't need to take my son's temperature to realize that he's lethargic, he's warm to the touch, he's droopy. So for me, like that makes way more sense. Yes, he's not feeling good because these are the symptoms I see. So maybe even like in what's quantifiable, is that maybe one of the big differences?
I think you can look at it that way. But as I understand it, it's not necessarily what's quantifiable. But I look at the details as to where somebody who uses intuition looks at the whole,
mm-hmm.
or they gather information from the whole. Somebody who uses intuition tends to be more willing to kind of brainstorm things and kind of see things as they can be.
It's more the creative side, correct?
No, I don't know that I would say that. Oh, okay. I would say that none of these is more or less than anything else. It's simply how we gather information. Because you can have some sensors who are very, very creative individuals. But really what it is it's the ability to, or not even the ability, the tendency to seek the details as opposed to seeking the what it could mean.
The big picture. That makes a ton of sense. Because I know for me, working with a VA, one of the most important things she does is handle these little minute detail things that I hate to have to worry about. And she's really, really good at keeping track of the details. So as an intuitor, if I'm more inclined to look at things in the big picture, I'm going to be less inclined to want to, you know, make sure my Nook back matter links to my Nook, you know, book two, you know, all these little itty bitty details. So if you like the details, and it's possible that you would be the sensor, right? Is that one way to gauge?
That's one of the gauges that
You know, and it's interesting because I'm definitely the intuitor, but I don't mind the numbers. You know, I like looking at my ad numbers and things like that, but I also will look at it more big picture. So for example, I'm trying to think of how this would apply to authors. And I think like a sensor, someone who looks at the numbers and the data, they might say something like, I have a 4.7 star average. That's pretty darn good. Whereas the intuitor might be more interested in like looking at those reviews and seeing the trends that come out, how the reviews make that person feel. Would you say that that's kind of an example?
Yeah, I think that's a good example. Another example I might use is, you know, as a sensor, when I'm writing a book, I might be more interested in the research and getting all of the details of the plot in place. I'm not a writer, so I don't know. I'm guessing.
Yeah, I know that makes a ton of sense.
As an intuitor, I might have the overall story in mind and the plot just kind of takes care of itself.
Yeah, I would be super interested to see the difference between like pantsing and plotting as well. Are you familiar with those?
Oh, yeah, pantsing. Yeah. Well, you said pantsing. First thing I thought was, you know, elementary school.
Down.
Yeah, dropping your trowel.
Yeah. So, you know, an intuitor, like I don't do much plotting or outlining. So an intuitor, they might be more likely, if you're an intuitive writer, you might be more likely to not worry about the outline and go where the story leads you. Maybe even be more character driven as opposed to a sensor. It might even be more plot driven, perhaps. And yeah, I could see how a sensor might feel more comfortable, you know, knowing beginning to end a little bit more, things like that.
Yeah, I would guess that some of the great writers or you know, I think specifically of somebody who's incredibly detailed, like a Tolkien, you know, where he gives so much detail.
He has to keep track of so many moving parts.
Yeah, I would guess he's more of a sensor. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or even a Stephen King, if you're familiar with Stephen King's writings. I mean, one of the reasons, you know, his book, can I say that the book title?
Yeah.
The Stand, you know, it was such a, you know, I thought it was a great book, but it was so incredibly detailed that he almost has to be a censor. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I can't speak for
old Steven. We've
never
sat down and
Steven.
Talked to him. But yeah, sometimes it is a fun, I'll do this with my characters. I'll look at a character, and this is something else you can keep in mind with the sensing and intuition, is that some characters are going to be a lot more, like they're going to gather information by what they see, you know, like a Sherlock Holmes type or something. Or would you say Sherlock Holmes was an intuitor, though? Because he kind of assimilated a bunch of data at once.
He assimilated the data and then came up with his understanding of the data.
Uh-huh.
So I would guess that he was a perfect example of a sensor, even though he said,
okay.
You know.
Even though he kind of gathers it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an interesting one.
Yeah, because he's getting all the details.
True.
What was it that he said to... it's elementary. I was going to say it was intuition, dear Watson. No, it's elementary, Watson or whatever it is.
Yeah,
I would guess, you know, that mystery novels, they kind of tickle that sensor person.
Yeah,
because
you're gathering the data, coming to your conclusions. You know, if you're going way deeper into like psychology and character development, I could see that being more of the intuitive side of things. Yeah. The next pair is where we at, how you make decisions, right?
Yep, it's how you make decisions. So now you have gathered the information, and since you've gathered the information using your senses or using your intuition, now you're going to be making decisions with that information that you've gathered. And that's where we're going to get to the next process pair, which is thinking or feeling.
This is maybe even the most charged difference, would you say?
I absolutely think this is the one that people get most defensive about, because there are some potentially major pitfalls if you don't understand this.
Or maybe even not defensive, but just like, I can think of a lot of our disagreements probably boil down to thinking versus feeling.
Sure. Yep.
I'll go ahead and start. So I'm a feeler. And basically what that means is I make decisions based on whether or not they feel like the right decision to me. So this doesn't mean like you throw rules out the window or something, but a really good example that I can think of that shows my feeling and Scott's thinking. Can I tell them about when we moved?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So we had to move. It was maybe like a 3-hour move. And so Scott was on Craigslist and found a place to rent that in his mind checked all the boxes of what we would need in a house, and basically was ready to almost sight unseen say, hey, we want this place. And we did drive in like the very next day. We drove in with the kids to look at it. The person showing us the house was right there. Basically, we needed to decide right then, in that, you know, I bet we only spent 10 minutes, you know, in the house, and we had to decide if we were going to take it. And so Scott is a thinker. Like I said, it checked all of his boxes, and it was super close to work, and it had the right number of bedrooms, and it was available. I'm like, hey, let's do it. And for me, it was so much more like my ideal house shopping would be checking out several different places, walking around.
Literally walking around.
Literally walking around. Like, I'm a huge pacer, guys. And that was one of my issues. I looked at this house. I'm like, it's not a long enough hallway to pace. But, you know, walking around, envisioning where's my office going to go. And the biggest one, one of the biggest ones, can I picture working here? Can I picture eating my meals here with the family? Can I picture going to bed in, you know, in this particular room? And not knowing that, it was really, really hard. Spoiler alert. It is the place that we chose, and it's working out just fine. But it was really hard for me to make that decision. I was really, really in a bad mood that day. I'll go ahead and admit it.
Well, and you know, with as a thinker, what we tend to do, and again, I use that word tendency because it's important, but we tend to make decisions based on logical understandings. There really isn't much room as a thinker for kind of that feeling. How is this going to affect things? Well, I look more at the bottom line.
Yeah. If it's the right decision, it's the right decision.
Exactly.
Case closed.
Yeah. And that can be extremely difficult for a lot of people, because they expect to be able to use their feelings and say, well, you know, how is this going to affect my values? That's, you know, it's not necessarily a feeling really doesn't have a whole lot to do with emotion. As much to do with emotion as it has to do with how a particular decision fits into your value set. Mm-hmm. For me as a thinker, my value set may not be the most important thing. You know, like in my job, as Alana said, I supervise foster homes. And so I will place youth into a foster home, and I will look at the specific information that is going to affect the youth, affect the home, and I will try to gather a logical decision. This decision has nothing to do with how I feel about it.
Right.
It has everything to do with, is this the right place based on all the information provided?
And I'm sure if I were in that position, which I would never survive well in your job, but I think for me, it would be more of, like I said, that picture. Can I picture this child getting along with his family? Based on what I, as a thinker, it's easier for him to explain the linear progression of, you know, A, B, C, and D equals E. Whereas for me, like, it would be harder for me to explain things like, okay, I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but I know there have been times where I'm like, well, no, I don't want to do this, or this is a decision I think we should make. But it's harder for me to explain that because it's all happening internally, and it's not really based on like logic or equations necessarily. So a really good example from the writing world would be like a thinker would probably be totally fine with saying, hey, this is a hot genre. I bet I could write in it and dive in. Whereas a feeler would have to really, do a lot of internal questioning. Can I see myself doing this genre? Is this a project I would love? And so I do that, a lot. A lot of my decisions, if I were a thinker, I would make a lot of different decisions because I would probably be more able to say, hey, this sounds like a good business decision. Scott and I have been talking about my shiny object syndrome project, and I think that's like almost all feelers. Like, this sounds exciting.
It is. I think it does give some really keen insight into who we are as we start to understand how these tendencies affect everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
As a thinker, I really don't care about, it sounds bad, I don't care about feelings.
Yeah.
Because I want to make the right decision based on all the information. And so as a writer, I would say, look, I know that I can make $100,000 a year writing in this genre. That's what mm-hmm. I'm going to do. It has really nothing to do with whether or not I feel like this is the best genre now.
Right.
Now, and I say nothing to do with, but I'm using kind of an extreme example here. There's always, I'm always going to be taking in my personal values. I'm not going mm-hmm. to write in a genre that doesn't fit my value system mm-hmm. or anything like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, but I think in a feeler would have a lot harder time writing something that they weren't kind of creatively behind.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would agree that a thinker is probably going to be more likely, or they would tend more likely to write based on how successful they know they can be.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, that neither of these is better or worse, and they're both totally valid, and the world would be a real mess if we were all thinkers or if we were all feelers. It'd be a major mess.
Even, a marriage could be a real mess.
Like,
it's important for us to realize that we are very different people,
mm-hmm.
but that it's those differences that really make us, I think, a successful couple.
Well, and the fact that we are so different means that we are always kind of in checks and balance with each other.
Sure.
So I doubt that there would ever be a decision that we would dive into. Like, let's say, hypothetically, you could take a job in Texas and it would double our income. And if we were both just thinking, looking at the numbers, we both might say, sure, let's do it. And not even take into account how it would affect the kids, any of those kinds of things. And so I think it is, I really appreciate that we have both sides to look at things.
Mm-hmm.
And so something for you to think about too in your relationships. I think, Scott, you do an amazing job understanding that I have shiny object syndrome, but I'm not sure that you totally understand it, because in your mind it's like, hey, you found something that works, keep writing these books that work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, if I do that, I'm afraid I might, get tired of this or things like that. And I think you've done a great job, even if it's not the way you would work, you just kind of understand that about me. And so, just thinking about even your relationships, maybe some tension if you're having issues creatively with somebody else, or, especially if you're in a co-writing relationship and one of you is a thinker and one of you is a feeler, I could see that being a big sticky point.
Huge possible stress,
yeah.
Especially if you don't understand how each other mm-hmm. operates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true of any team setting.
Yeah.
I look at my team within my job, and we have a team of 10 people plus our director, and I don't think any of us are, I think the likelihood is that no two of us are exactly the same.
Yeah.
And when we're trying to interact on a team level, that can be really, really difficult because
mm-hmm.
everybody's got different expectations. And so I can only imagine within a writing relationship where you're trying to put out a product, an artistic product,
mm-hmm.
that could have a huge impact by not understanding how your co-writer, who is a feeler, is
right.
understanding things versus your thinking.
Yeah.
That can be a point of contention.
Oh, for sure. Like if I were co-writing, I know some relationships, it's like one person writes the outline, the next person writes the first draft. I could see myself not doing that well, being the person writing a first draft based on someone else's outline, because
mm-hmm.
I might get to chapter 5 and my co-writer says, and now character A does this. And if I'm not behind that, I'm like, well, I can't make character A do that. That's not what she would do or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then lastly, we've got judging and perceiving. I think out of all of these are like the worst named of them all.
Yeah. And the names actually came from some pretty significant research, and we don't have time right now to get into it. There's a reason that they chose that, and that gets into some pretty like in-depth psychological issues in a good way. I mean, issues usually mean something bad.
Right.
But the judging and perceiving is how we kind of react with the world around us, or how we interact with the world around us. And that can be very interesting to try to figure out, because they, again, also have some, I mean, even with the name judging, you think of judging, you think somebody's going to be judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
And that has nothing at all to do with what it means.
Or even perceiving, you know, like that seems to me like what you're looking at.
Yeah, like I can perceive something.
Yeah, I'm a sensor, I'm a perceiver. What's the difference?
Yeah, so as a perceiver, and I am a perceiver, and actually my beloved here has helped me understand that a lot more. For me, I've come to understand that I am very much driven by a deadline.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will always get the work done, but I will get the work done at the last possible moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just kind of, you know, always be thinking about it going into it. But then I'll finally do it when it's time to do it, not before, because it would be a waste of my time. Because I can be doing other things. Maybe I can be doing a fun something or other. And so it's a challenge, I think, for people to understand what that means. It doesn't mean that I'm going to do it wrong, but, you know, like one of the issues that I can really think of this becoming a problem is going to be in something like a group project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a group project where you're the opposite of a perceiver, which is a judger, which means you have kind of everything very specifically lined out and when it's going to happen and the order it's going to happen. And a perceiver who's going to wait until the last possible moment and do it and even do a good job.
Right.
But the judge is waiting on the perceiver, and the perceiver saying, stop nagging me. It'll get done.
Right. So the judger is the kind of person who plans ahead, and the perceiver likes to be more spontaneous, things like that. I mean, do you feel like that's a decent...
Yeah. And likes to isn't even necessarily the right thing. I think it's just that natural, like this is just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to, I want to put that caveat in there, because a lot of people think that, well, I like to do this and therefore maybe I can change it because it's just like,
mm-hmm.
but in reality, it's kind
it's
of an
how you work.
Ingrown part of who you are. Yeah. In fact, Jung would say this is very much part of our nature as opposed to being the way that we were nurtured.
Yeah.
These are our born tendencies.
Quality, yeah. In college, I called myself a reverse procrastinator, because I would try to get everything done, you know, a month ahead of time, because I don't like the deadlines. So in the writing world, the judger, so the person who kind of plans everything out ahead of time, they might be more likely to like to do the outline. I would be the exception to that. But some judgers, I'm sure, would really like the very heavy outlines, and the perceivers, like what Scott was saying with deadlines, the perceivers would very likely be the kind of people who would put up a KDP pre-order just so that they had a date that they had to write it by. Because if there's not any external factors involved, it just becomes too easy to push it back.
You know, the funny thing is, I have no idea what you just said.
Oh, because that's the pre-orders?
Yeah, you're speaking a language that I don't speak. But I think I get the overall feel for what you're saying. Yeah, I might need to have a deadline in order to make something happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because without that, yeah, it just might not happen, because I don't have a reason to get it done.
And, you know, a perceiver author might be more of the seat of the pants kind of writer. I'm going to write when fancy strikes. Now, I think there's a place to be disciplined, but there's also a place to let creativity do its thing. So my joke is that I'm very much a judger in that I like to have my structure and my plans and my goals, but my muse is totally the opposite. So that's an interesting dynamic. I don't know if any of you listening have that same issue. Like, I'm super disciplined in my work schedule and things like that, but when it comes to the creativity, I really don't know what I'm going to be doing. So for example, like I might know that on Wednesday I'm going to have a writing day, and I don't know what I'm going to be writing until I show up to my computer. You know, I'm really good at being disciplined, carving out that time to write, but I don't know what I'm going to be writing yet. So Any other judging versus perceiving differences that you can think of that impact the writing life specifically?
That impact the writing life specifically? You know, not necessarily. I just think the one thing that I want to make clear is that being a judger doesn't mean you're judgmental. Being a perceiver doesn't mean that you're always, you know, kind of, for lack of better terms, ditzy.
Flighty.
You know, yeah, you can have, you have your way of doing it.
And I think you can be disciplined regardless. You know, I wouldn't want somebody to say, oh, well, I'm a perceiver, so I can't stick to my word count goal or something. That's probably more of a cop out.
Well, and that's true of all of these. And now might be a good time just to kind of give a little bit of a reminder here, is that none of these things, even though they're inborn, even though they're our tendencies, none of these things mean we can't do the other. Sometimes we can do the other to one degree of quality versus another. I don't know that I said that well. But because I am a natural extrovert doesn't mean that I cannot do introverted things. Mm-hmm. Or just because you are a natural intuitor doesn't mean that you can't look at details.
Right.
These are all important parts of life that we have to do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will find that in their home life versus their work life, or maybe, you know, your writing life versus your family life, or however you want to break that up, you can have two very different tendencies.
For sure.
Because just like any habit, you can train yourself to do something. You know, I kind of like to look at it this way, and this kind of goes back to, you know, kind of the very beginning when we start to look at tendencies. My tendency, not my tendency, the way that I work is I am a right-handed person. When I sign my name, I do so with my right hand. Doesn't mean I can't train myself to do so with my left hand. Mm-hmm. It just means that I choose not to unless there's a reason. But if I break my right arm, I'm going to have to train myself to use it. It doesn't mean I can't do it. And sometimes, you know, early on in life, we train ourselves to be a certain way because that's the expectation. Mm-hmm. But when we're honest with ourselves, I think we start to see our natural tendency. And that helps us understand just kind of on a deeper level who we are.
Yeah. Well, thank you to Scott for joining us. Thank you to those of you listening. Scott, like I said, has his certification now to walk people through the official test. So, you know, you can find free online tests that will give you a feel for your Myers-Briggs personality type, but he's got the official.
Well, can I jump in on that? Mm-hmm. The free tests that are out there do not actually use the Myers-Briggs formula. They don't use the Myers-Briggs research. They use the letters, but if there's a free test out there, really what they've done is they've come up with their own version, and those are a lot less consistent. One thing with the Myers-Briggs type indicator is it's very, very consistent and reliable because it's got decades of research behind it. I mean, this is a tool that 89 out of the Fortune 100 companies use on a regular basis for their businesses. They don't use the free ones that are on there because the free ones really don't do what you think they're going to do. They're not legally able to use the Myers-Briggs materials.
So if you're interested in the official test, what that involves is the online questionnaire, and then you can sit down with Scott going over your test results as well as more in-depth into each of these facets. So if that sounds intriguing to you, I'll go ahead and include a link in the show notes. For right now, at least, it's November 2019. You can also get a time management consultation with me. We're kind of pairing up these together because, you know, the more you understand about your personality, the more it really is going to help your productive output, your creative output. So if you guys are interested in more of that, check out the show notes. And thank you again, Scott, and thanks to everyone who joined us.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks.